we're investors, we're looking for a return on investment. And if you're not operating in a market that's big and growing, then where are we going to get our return? And in that, I really want to see entrepreneurs that understand their customer. I love it when I'm in a conversation with an entrepreneur and they're just teaching me stuff about their customer base because they just know them inside out. So I look for that. And then I look at the product. You know, are you building a product that is somehow unique in the market, is defensible, isn't easy to replicate? Are you using technology to scale that business? Or that? So I look at the product. And then the last thing I look at is the economics. So do your unit economics make sense? So first of all, do you have a way to create recurring revenue so that even if you aren't able to continue being capitalized, you can continue to make money? Mm-hmm. And then what's your cost of acquisition versus the value of the customer? So because that indicates whether or not you have the ability to scale.
Doing this because after 2 days of trying to fix a virtual interview, the network that shall not be named decided that we are better off doing this in person. So here I am today with you. So first of all, let's start with an introduction.
So I'm Oyi Shelebo. I'm the managing director of ARM Labs Lagos Techstars Accelerator. And this is a partnership between ARM and Techstars. So Techstars is the world's largest pre-seed investor. We invest in startups all across the world, have invested through one of our accelerators in around 3,500 startups with a cumulative market cap of around $100 billion. And I run our only program currently on the African continent in partnership with ARM. And ARM is Nigeria's largest non-banking financial institution, and they have their own incubator program called ARM Labs, hence the name ARM Labs Lagos Techstars Accelerator. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Yes, not a bit, it's actually a mouthful. So how did you, what was your practice like when you wanted to get the name, the full name, ARM Labs Lagos Techstars Program?
Well, I wasn't part of that decision. but, you know, ultimately, ARM Labs are the partner that's making it happen.
Yeah.
Hence why ARM Labs in there is very important. But obviously, Techstars then bring the experience since 2006 of running accelerator programs and investing in startups. So Techstars is in there as well.
All right. So Techstars, as we've mentioned, is the largest pre-seed investor. And ARM Labs is the largest non-banking financial institution in Nigeria. How did you get to lead an organization that is basically a fusion of the strengths of both organizations?
Yeah.
So how did you get to this point?
So I joined as the managing director last October.
Yeah.
And it was actually a really quick process bringing me into the role. But my background is I'm Nigerian, but as my accent gives away, I was born and bred in the UK.
Okay.
I studied there. I did my undergraduate there at the London School of Economics. I did my executive MBA there at the London Business School. And I started my career in investment management at a bank, investment bank called Goldman Sachs in London. I did that for about 4 years. I spent a year in strategy consulting for a company called Roden Berger, which is a European strategy consulting firm, but I helped them set up their Nigeria practice.
Okay.
And that was my first opportunity actually working and living in Nigeria. Before that, I'd just been back for parties and weddings and, you know, champagne lifestyle. So that was my first opportunity actually understanding what it's like to live here. And then since then, I've just always been looking for ways to come back. After that, I went back into investment management, and then I was a founder. So I co-founded a company called Move Me Back, which is still going today And that's a global members community that connects the world to African opportunities. So in doing that, I had the privilege of building a strong global network of operators and leaders, graduates, people of typically African heritage who were just doing awesome things and somehow contributing back to Africa that wanted to find more opportunities to do that. So I think when you then combine all of those things, so my background in investment and then my background in community building, it made for a nice, I guess,
synergy,
that brought me into the role for managing director.
So for some reason, we then see a lot of former investment bankers, former management consultants, either get into investment VC roles or they get to start, they get to start their own startups. I don't know, startups. But yeah, what do you think it is about these two career paths that makes it easier or makes a lot of the people who've worked there in the past to get into entrepreneurship roles?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think on one side, there's something around the skills that you get when you're in consulting or banking. It teaches you to be a really good problem solver. And I think that ultimately is the key skill that you need as an entrepreneur. I think there are a lot of things that it teaches you that aren't useful for entrepreneurship. So even when I went into entrepreneurship, I had to unlearn a lot of the things that I'd learned. So for example, if you're in banking or consulting, you don't deliver a product until it's perfect. You can't do that as an entrepreneur. You've got to get really comfortable with delivering something that you're later embarrassed by to test it in the market. So things like that, that kind of skill set aren't so useful, but the problem solving side is really useful. I think the second thing is that they're quite lucrative career paths. So you tend to make enough money where you then have the flexibility to then be an entrepreneur. And like, let's not kid ourselves, being an entrepreneur is a really risky thing. So having some money in your pocket just makes it easier to do that. Mm-hmm. And then I think the third thing is that I think a lot of people get really disillusioned when they're working in these sectors because they have this idea that they're going to make impact and be able to drive decisions. And then the reality is that you can't. So I feel like a lot of these people are really smart, really driven, and they want to find a way to make more impact, and they see that they can't necessarily do that in the corporate world, so they look for ways to do it themselves.
All right, fair enough. Okay, so let's talk about Techstars. Like you mentioned earlier, are the largest pre-seed investor. That comes with a lot of experience, and you just launched the ARM Labs Lagos Techstars program in Africa. That's the first that we have here in Africa. So what do you look for when you are accepting startups? So your first cohort had 12 people.
Yes.
And earlier I was asking you how many applications you got. So what do you look for when you are getting down to these 12 startups?
Yeah. So it's the first one in Nigeria, this program. Okay. We previously actually had a program with Barclays in South Africa.
Okay.
So we're the only one in Africa at the moment, but I do hope that changes. But what we look for, so I think the first thing is team. Like, that is crucial. Finding a team that is really passionate about the problem that they are solving and not the solution. Mm-hmm. So you find, I have conversations with entrepreneurs all the time where they're really excited about the solution. And I'm like, so what problem are you solving? And then they can't quite articulate it. And the problem with that is that quite often you have to pivot. You know, you have to listen to feedback and your customer says, I don't want this, I don't want that, I want this instead.
Yeah.
And if you're addicted to the solution, it doesn't give you that ability to flex. So I look for founders that are really passionate about the problem they're solving. Founders that are really coachable as well. Feedback is a gift. And as an entrepreneur, you need to get really good at taking feedback from your customers, but then also from people that may have more expertise than you. And not to say the feedback's always good. It may be bad advice, but you still need to have the kind of that muscle to take it as a gift and test it and see if it works. So I look for people that are really coachable. The other thing is that it's an accelerator program. It's a boot camp. I'm going to be working with you for 3 months every day. You're going to be calling me on the weekends, calling me late at night. So there needs to be that kind of rapport there where I know that I can have a healthy conversation with you that is feedback driven both ways, actually. So team is really important. Oh, and also a team that has executed, has a track record of executing. I get a lot of ideas. So I want to see that the team, even if they haven't executed on that idea, they have a track record of execution. So team is a key thing. The next thing I look at is the market. Are you operating in a market that is sizable, that is growing? Because ultimately we're investors, we're looking for a return on investment. And if you're not operating in a market that's big and growing, then where are we gonna get our return? And in that, I really want to see entrepreneurs that understand their customer. I love it when I'm in a conversation with an entrepreneur and they're just teaching me stuff about their customer base because they just know them inside out. So I look for that. The next thing I look for is traction. So traction could mean users. It could mean revenue. And ideally, it does mean revenue because we're in an environment where, you know, cash is king. So yeah. I want to see some form of traction. And again, it speaks to your ability to execute. And then I look at the product. You know, are you building a product that is somehow unique in the market, is defensible, isn't easy to replicate? Are you using technology to scale that business? So I look at the product. And then the last thing I look at is the economics. So do your unit economics make sense? So first of all, do you have a way to create recurring revenue so that even if you aren't able to continue being capitalized, you can continue to make money? Mm-hmm. And then what's your cost of acquisition versus the value of the customer? So because that indicates whether or not you have the ability to scale. So in summary, I look for the team, market, traction, product, and then the economics.
Okay, so two questions about the team. First is, how do you gauge passion? Because it's not everyone is immediately and obviously so passionate about it. So one, how do you gauge passion? To how do you gauge coachability? Because there's a power dynamic between the investor and the founder. So I speak to a few founders who say that there really isn't a lot of money. So when they get opportunities, they just have to conform in a way to the investor's demands. So there's like a power dynamic that is skewed in favor of the investor. So how do you accurately gauge that a founder is really coachable and not basically bowing to your wishes because he knows I need this money. So how do you do that?
It's a really good question. So the first one is, how do I gauge
passion?
If you're founding a business and you can't speak passionately about what you're doing, mm-hmm. how are you gonna sell? How are you gonna continue to raise capital? So if you aren't able to speak passionately about what you're doing, then maybe you're doing the wrong thing, to be honest. I'm yet to find a founder, even if you're shy, even if you're an introvert, I'm yet to find a founder that isn't able to, a good founder that's, you know, with traction, that's building something incredible, that isn't able to speak passionately about what they're doing. You know, if I ask them, how's your day, and I have small talk, maybe they're quiet. But then when I ask them about their product, they're like that. So I do have to see that in some shape or form.
So that means you need to have conversations with
them. And I think it's partly my role to make sure I create that safe space for them to show me that. Because to your second question, it's true. I know that a lot of founders feel a lot of pressure to
please the investor.
And I think that the unique thing about an accelerator is you're working with your investor. So it's not a situation where the investor invests and then they're kind of like sitting up here and you're here. I'm working alongside you every day. So I think part of my job is making sure that the founder feels comfortable being really vulnerable, being really honest about where they are, not BSing me, because then I can't help. And if I haven't created that environment for them to do that, then I'm doing something wrong. So, you know, to your question around testing for coachability, it's a really difficult one, because I can say that I remember in our screening committee, one of our startups, one of the feedback that we got on them was they're not coachable. And they are the company who, during the accelerator program, were the most coachable. So I had taken that feedback, we wouldn't have selected them. And I think that, again, just goes to spending enough time with them during the interview process so they can let down their guard and then see whether or not they take feedback. And one of the things I do is I'll play devil's advocate. I'll ask them questions that will get their back up a little bit. And then just see, are they defending? Or at some point, they sit back and be like, okay, all right, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Maybe there's something in that.
Okay. All right, so what's the Techstars advantage?
Advantage over other accelerators or just advantage for a startup?
For startups, and if you have any over other accelerators then.
Sure. So the Techstars advantage, we have this magic formula where we say capital plus program plus community equals opportunities. So the first advantage is the capital. We invest up to $120,000 in each startup. And that's really important to say because there are a lot of accelerator programs out there that don't provide the capital. Yeah. And I think particularly for African founders and then female African founders, they are very undercapitalized. So the capital is a big part. In addition to the capital, they have access to millions of dollars worth of perks from our partners. So the likes of AWS, Google, Brex, and also PayPal, also Paystack in Africa. And that helps them increase their runway. So there's the capital piece. And then there's the program, that's the second piece. So we run a 3-month in-person accelerator program here in Lagos. So it's a Pan-African program. We're looking for founders from across Africa, but we expect you as the founders to come to Lagos for the 3-month program. And it's curated. You will be delivered content specific to your stage of business. It's a mentor-led program as well, which is one of the advantages of Techstars, I think, over other accelerator programs. We acknowledge, and I acknowledge, I don't know everything. My team doesn't know everything. So we bring in mentors who are operational experts, functional experts, industry experts to work alongside the founders. Yeah. We have something called Mental Magic, where over the course of 2 weeks, the founders meet around 100 mentors who they then go on to work with across for the rest of the program and after the program. So that's super important. We have something called Investor Magic, where they meet investors to hopefully help them fundraise after the program. And we have Demo Day, which is where they present everything they've achieved and what they're working on to the ecosystem. Last year, we had a curated audience of around 400 people in person, half of which were investors. And we had another 2,500 people listening online. So the program is really important. And then there's the community piece. Outside of the program, the founders are brought into the Techstars community and network for life. And that includes 22,000 investors, around 8,000 previous Techstars alumni, and also thousands of mentors. And they can access all of those individuals for life. After the program, they then have access to our portfolio services team. So this is a team that's dedicated to working with the founders after the program to continue to help them fundraise. So yeah, it's the capital, it's the program, and it's the community.
All right. What do you think is the benefit that accelerators give to the economy? So like you mentioned, African startups are undercapitalized, they need a whole lot of resources. So what do you think is the benefit that accelerators hold for a country's startup ecosystem?
Yeah. So Techstars actually did a survey earlier this year. It's called the State of Innovation Survey, where we asked entrepreneurs in different countries what the biggest driver of innovation is in their region. And for every region, apart from Africa, those drivers were investors and the entrepreneur community. But for Africa, the biggest driver was accelerators. So I think we have data to show that accelerators are super important for the African ecosystem. Why? I think number one is that it just creates a hub, it creates an ecosystem that enables people to give to that community. So by the fact that we are in Lagos, that we have a physical program, we constantly had experts come in and speak to the founders and educate them, people that they otherwise wouldn't have had access to. You know, the likes of Tunde Kehinde, the first CEO of Jumia, the likes of Amandine LaBelle from the CEO of Paystack, Baudet, the COO of Flutterwave, Adedeji Oloye, the founder of Open Banking. So all of these people are coming in and giving to the community. And I think the fact that there's an accelerator program here gives them an avenue through which to access the startup. So that's the first thing, I think, just the ecosystem that it builds. The second thing is the capital. Again, you know, we talk every year, fundraising to Africa has increased. Great, but it's still less than 2% of global VC capital. So it brings more capital to the continent. And it also helps VCs from outside better tap into founders on the continent. So I speak to European and US VCs all the time who are like, they really want to invest in Africa, but the reason they don't is because they don't have partners on the ground who can help vet and do due diligence. Mm. So we do that. So we are creating hopefully a pipeline of opportunities for those VCs and for those investors outside of Africa. And then I think the other piece is around education. Okay. There's no other job that you do where you wouldn't be expected to have some kind of education apart from being a founder. As a founder, a lot of it is trial and error and learning from your mistakes. And I think an accelerator program provides a framework where they can actually just learn about some of the key things that are needed to succeed as an entrepreneur. You know, learn how to do your financial modeling, learn about how to scale operations, about how to hire correctly, how to put your people operations in place, talk to product experts about your product roadmap. So all of these things, this education that I think is kind of undervalued and underappreciated for entrepreneurs, accelerator programs provide that as well.
All right, so your last cohort, you're very proud of the fact that half of your cohort had 50% of them were women or women CEOs.
Yes.
And I was telling you earlier how difficult I found it to get women, first of all, to even apply for opportunities, and then to basically start this start businesses. And I've had conversations with a few of your portfolio companies, and they are, I'm talking about the women now, they're actually building solid products or solid businesses. So how were you able to achieve that? The second question is, what can we do to ensure that more women are taking up founding roles or are just starting businesses, basically?
Yeah. So how are we able to achieve it? I think the first thing is awareness. So the fact that you're even aware that there's an issue is amazing, because a lot of us aren't. And what we did is, when we saw that there was an issue, so when we saw that the vast majority of the applications were coming from men, we did something about it. Okay. And what that meant was that we actually went out and sourced more female founders. So network is really important. When I speak to female founders, often they're less likely to have actually heard of the opportunities, because I think men have stronger networks, they have bigger networks, and they have networks where they're more likely to share those opportunities among themselves. So the first thing is making sure that you tap into the female-focused networks. And there are loads of groups, WhatsApp groups, Facebook groups, etc. And I specifically targeted those alongside with my program manager and encouraged females to apply. The second piece is that encouragement. When I spoke to women who had heard of the program, some of them said to me, oh, I didn't apply because I didn't think I'm ready. And I hear that all the time, women feeling like they aren't ready. I can tell you, if I go to a networking event and there's a male CEO, and he's working on something, it's on paper for now, he has no customers, no product, versus a woman CEO who's been working something for 4 years, the man is more likely to come up to me and tell me about his business, ask me for my email address, share his pitch deck with me. So I think there's something that we need to do to actually encourage more women to apply and let them know you are ready. And even if you aren't ready, it's okay. Even if you get no, it's still part of the learning process. But unfortunately, I think that we as women, we are socialized to not step forward as much as men, and we're also socialized to take failure more personally. Yeah, I think there's some research out of Harvard that says that when a woman gets negative news, she feels it more than a man, and when she gets positive news, she feels it less than a man. So I think there's some kind of re-socializing and like social conditioning that needs to happen. You know, and I also think that the role of the man is really important in it. So in my cohort, one of the things that I was most impressed with was not actually the female CEOs, but the men behind the female CEOs. So we had one CEO who was pregnant during the program, and her male COO was constantly bigging her up, constantly pushing her forward, constantly saying, I'm not going to do that, she's going to do that because she's the CEO and that's her role and she deserves to be there. So really impressed by him. I've got another example of that. And then I've got an example of a female CEO who came from Kenya and had three children that she left behind. And she was able to do that because her husband was incredibly supportive at kind of picking up the reins and the responsibilities, and her family also were really supportive. So I think men need to back women with potential more as well, and that was definitely something that I saw with the female CEOs in my cohort.
Okay, so I think I should start looking for female communities to tap into. Do you have any recommendations for that?
It's mostly via like WhatsApp groups. So yes, I can literally send you some WhatsApp groups that you can tap into. But then the other thing is, it's I think about it takes more work, in honesty. First of all, there are less female entrepreneurs. Let's be very honest. There are less female entrepreneurs with tech backgrounds, and investors have a preference for tech founders, which makes sense. They're building tech products. They're great if you're technical. Women CEOs are less likely to be capitalized, so they're more likely to go into lifestyle businesses than they are scale up. So there are less. So we also, as the, I guess, gatekeepers of opportunity, just need to be out there more, finding them and speaking to them. And when I see a woman CEO come up to me and just introduce myself and walk away, I'm like, okay, come back. Tell me about your business. Let's have a conversation. Yeah. You know, so I think it's also something around taking it upon ourselves to pushing them.
That's more work.
It is more work. The other thing, sorry, that I will say is I think representation matters. So I think it's great that you're having the conversation with these women, but I think that sometimes it takes a woman to have a conversation with a woman. And at Techstars, we have a female CEO. At ARM, there's a female CEO. I'm a female leading the program, and I hear from women all the time that there's some kind of comfort that they feel in just applying because they can see examples of, you know, women leaders. So I think, yeah, representation really matters as well.
Okay, I see. All right, so how does your previous experience as a founder impact your work today with Techstars, with the cohort?
I think the first thing is it gives me a lot of empathy. Being a founder is not easy. It's really not easy. And I like to have really honest conversations with founders about that. It's not for everyone. And that's okay. We're not all supposed to be founders. Some of us are supposed to be employees. I recognize that the journey is incredibly difficult. And I think I take a really empathetic approach when I'm dealing with my founders. Like, we're people first. If that person isn't all right, then how do you expect them to lead a proper business? If the relationships they have with their co-founders isn't right, how do you expect them to have enough brain capacity to actually really focus on their business? So I think the first thing it gives me is a lot of empathy. I think the second thing it gives me is a kind of a customer-centric approach. I see my founders as my customer. And as an entrepreneur, you have to be customer-centric. You have to constantly take feedback and pivot based on what the feedback that you're getting. And I took the same approach with my founders. So yes, there was kind of a framework of what I wanted to deliver for the program, but at the same time, if the I constantly asked them for feedback, was constantly doing surveys with them, constantly having one-on-ones where I'd ask them, what do you think you need? And then that enabled me to change the kind of the scope of the program in alignment to what they needed.
Okay, so there's a conversation that is probably going to be going on for a while. Building in public versus building in private. What would you prefer, or which of them would you choose for a founder or would you advise your founder to go for?
A combination of both. Not that I'm sitting on the fence. I think there are some parts that don't need to be private, public, but then at the same time, the benefit of building publicly is that you get that constant feedback. Okay. I think that if you're building a product where you're so scared that if you build in public that someone will copy it, then that's not a defensible product. There's an issue there.
Okay.
So I think that if you're really scared of your product being easily copied, then it's perhaps not a product that is going to kind of scale and last. So I think there has to be a combination of keeping some things that are proprietary in private, but then in terms of getting that feedback, it's really important to go out there, speak to people, speak to your customers, speak to potential investors, speak to people that have kind of been there, done that before, to get that feedback to help you pivot your business. And to be honest, I see a lot of that. I see a lot of founders that are really open about what they're building, and that gives them that constant feedback. But then I also see founders who complain that someone has copied their business. But ultimately, I think it's around execution. You know, it's around your ability to execute, and it's around your ability to find something that is really defensible. So even if someone hears about it at a high level, they can't immediately go and copy.
That's really valuable advice. I didn't think about that. If you have a defensible product, I've always wondered, why would you want to build in public? But now I realized, if your idea or your product is not defensible, then you're probably better off not building that product at all. So yeah, good advice. All right, so final question would be, this is based on something that just happened recently. So a startup discovered that, they had already announced that we raised X amount of money and then an investor pulled out. And it's not immediately obvious to a founder, especially if you're new to the game, that this investor has the money, or in investor speak, has dry powder for you.
Yeah.
So it's not immediately obvious. How would I go about it if I was a founder? To just know that, okay, this guy who is speaking with me or he's speaking to me actually has the money to invest in me.
Sure. So investors do a lot of due diligence on founders, and I encourage my founders to do a lot of due diligence on their investor. The first thing is that actually, we are in an economic environment where it might happen, where the capital might run dry, and for legitimate reasons, the investor pulls out. But if the investor is pulling out and they never had that capital to begin with, and they don't have a track record of investing, or they have a track record of pulling out previously, then the question is, did the founder do enough due diligence on that investor? And due diligence can look like asking the investor, show me your portfolio companies, can I speak to one of your portfolio companies? It could be using your community to actually identify that portfolio company and reaching out to them directly and asking the founder about their experience with that investor. I also encourage the founders to try and identify companies that failed that worked with an investor to understand how that investor actually treated them during that process. So ultimately the answer, I think, to the question is the founder should be doing as much due diligence on the investor as the investor does on them. And it's okay, it should be a two-way relationship, I think founders need to remember that, yes, you need the capital, but those capital providers also need you to create a return, right? So it has to be a two-way relationship. If it's a relationship where the investor, it feels like the investor's here and you're here, then it's not going to work. You want an investor that you feel is going to work alongside you, is going to be really strategic, is going to be actively invested in your success. And I think that kind of investor is going to be open to you doing a little bit of due diligence on them. And also demonstrates that you as a founder, you're a good decision maker. Like, you do the research, you do the work to make sure that you're getting into partnership with
the right people.
Exactly.
Okay, I think I have one more question. So how do I get to be a really good investor? You've been a founder and now you're an investor.
Well,
so you sat on both tables.
I'm still early, I have to be honest. I'm still early. So So what do I see of people that I can say you're a good investor? I think what I see from them is they have a lot of conversations. Okay. Like, they're constantly having conversations with founders, constantly looking at what's going on in other markets, and not to replicate those models, but to kind of like observe the direction of channel, the direction to see whether or not there are some implications for what's going on in the continent. So I think you have to be, number one, you have to spend the time having a lot of conversations. I think number two is you need to have a team or other people around you that can help you make the right decisions. I think that what that means is not having the ego to say, I'm a good investor, I'm going to make the right decision, but rather leaning on other people that may have domain expertise or may have seen similar models before you to ask them for your advice. And that is something I'm super open to doing. You know, I don't know all the answers. I will never know all the answers. So what I do a lot is I lean on other people in the industry. So for example, the last stage of the interview process with the accelerator is a screening committee. And last year that was a 15-person screening committee that involved some people from Techstars, including other managing directors. It included people from ARM, our partners. And then I also invited external investors, Olumide Soyinbo, Fopper from Helios, Charlene Chen, who was a COO at Azar Finance, and Ashim from Octera Capital. So these are people that have been investing for a long time. I lent on their expertise to help me make that decision. So that's the decision part. But then there's also, it doesn't stop at the decision. It doesn't stop when you make an investment. I think to be a really good investor, you also have to appreciate that it's not just about the capital, but it's also about what else can you bring. And what else you can bring may be your own expertise. It may be about opening doors to other investors or other advisors for your founder. It may be you just having really good listening skills, so you're understanding what the problem is in that startup. It may be you being just creating an environment where the startup can be really vulnerable to tell you what challenges they're having so you can find a solution before it gets really difficult. So I think there's a piece around being able to make a really good decision, but then there's also that kind of relationship advisory strategic piece around how can I actively help that company grow and not just see myself as a capital provider.
All right. So I think with that, we come to the close of this conversation. It's been an exciting conversation. And thank you so much for your time. And we should do a different conversation some other time. Could be next year, could be later this year. But
for sure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.